I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. How about a show of hands? How many of you have already broken your New Year's resolutions? Should we even make resolutions? Do we do something wrong when we break them? Today, the ethics professors discuss these questions and ask, do resolutions differ from other sorts of promises or contracts? Do they involve a kind of self-deception, and is such deception morally problematic? When political candidates make promises and then switch positions, should they be called flip-floppers, or are such changes in philosophy understandable and even acceptable? Later on this hour, Brian McTavish returns with what he supposedly promises is a great weekend to-do list. But if it's not, we'll be forgiving, right? It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The American Heritage Dictionary defines resolution as firm determination. So are your New Year's resolutions still in place? Are you sticking to it? Today, a conversation with our ethics professors about the implications of failing to keep the promises we make. We'll also talk about candidates for public office and what it really means when they don't keep their promises. The ethics professors are Wayne Vaught. He's the interim dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and director of the Center for Applied and Professional Ethics at UMKC. Wayne, always good to have you.
Good to be here again.
Clancy Martin's back. He's chair of the Department of Philosophy and professor of philosophy at UMKC. He's authored, co-authored, and edited several books in philosophy, including Love, Lies, and Marriage. And Clancy, nice to have you too.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Wayne, are you keeping your New Year's resolutions, or where are you here?
I quit making them.
Me too.
I figure the best way to keep my resolutions is not to actually make any, and so don't worry about breaking them at all.
Yeah.
No, I actually didn't make any real New Year's resolutions. Well, it's sort of the typical, I was going to eat better, maybe lose a few pounds, but that lasted until I think the third.
That's the thing with New Year's resolutions. And Clancy, your list of resolutions surely was very, very long and detailed.
As usual, yes. It was long and detailed.
Was it?
It's funny because I made a list with a friend of mine about we made our lists together. And then we looked at it and we were like, none of these sound like fun. We don't have anything down here that sounds like it's actually we're going to enjoy. So then we like threw up the lists and tried to think of other resolutions that would actually make our enhance our lives in a more fun way.
You know, our conversation here just causes me to think that one issue with New Year's resolutions is people talk about them and then they sort of laugh about them. Mm-hmm, they're really not in culture anymore, Wayne. They're really not taken all that seriously, it seems to me.
Well, I don't know if they ever were taken especially seriously, but it is kind of a jovial thing to do, and they're almost always negative, right? I mean, do people make positive New Year's resolutions? I'm going to have more fun this year. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do X, Y, or Z.
Well, sometimes, yeah.
I guess they might try to get away from work or types of things like that. But I think that they're generally considered sort of a frivolous thing that we do, and it's not something that's taken very seriously. So breaking them doesn't cause us any real harm, or we don't feel we've done anything particularly morally egregious when we break our promises or our promises in terms of New Year's resolutions. I do wonder, though, that if engaging in that type of activity, even superficially like with New Year's resolutions, might not carry over to other types of promises so that it makes other types of contractual things that we do
that's
seem
the issue.
Less,
on the table here.
Right. Yeah. That it makes it seem less egregious when I don't make when I don't keep another type of promise that maybe I've made with someone else. You know, the New Year's resolution is typically a promise one makes with oneself, and so you can only get so upset with yourself for breaking your promises to yourself. But when you someone else enters into the conversation, then it becomes a little more of an ethical challenge.
Well, and you can get plenty upset with yourself for breaking promises to yourself, too. I mean, speaking as an alcoholic, you know, that's really ultimately a promise that you're making yourself that you're not going to take a drink. And it's if you relapse, you can get plenty of upset with yourself. But there's this old fascinating debate about this very subject, but that took place really in the pages of a book called The Nicomachean Ethics, written by Aristotle. But Socrates had an idea that virtue was knowledge, that because no one would willingly do themselves harm. If they knew the right thing to do, they would just do it, right? And in general, when we think about New Year's resolutions and other kinds of promises, promises we make other people, the premise is that this is the right thing to do. And if it's the right thing to do, why don't you simply do it? I mean, if it is the right thing for you to exercise more, why aren't you doing it, et cetera, et cetera? And Socrates held this view because no one would willingly do themselves harm, which seems right. But then Aristotle pointed out that he was failing to take into account a part of human psychology, which the Greek word is akrasia. Krasia means power and a just means not power. And what it's generally translated as is weakness of will. That is, sometimes you can know exactly what the right thing to do is, but you still are just incapable of making yourself do it.
Right.
And I think that's – I think in a lot of cases of promise breaking, both to oneself and to another human being, it's not that it's not that, for example, if I made a promise to Steve to show up on the show on Tuesday, when I made the promise, I probably fully intended to show up on the show on Tuesday. It was not that I was lying to you and deliberately manipulating you. It's that, and then something happens between now and Tuesday that makes me incapable of willing myself to do the work to keep the promise.
And that would make me incapable of inviting you back to be on the show ever again, Clancy, if that ever happened.
Just so we're clear. Let's not do that, Potato.
Is that a promise?
If we can't count on you, you can call it whatever you want, Wayne. It is what it is.
What figures into this debate in an interesting way too? This I work on all this stuff in my professional philosophical work, and one thing that comes into the debate is the question of the degree to which we have free will at all. And if you think about the natural universe, you realize that if you hold out, if you hold a ball and you release it, you know it's going to fall, and you know it's going to fall every time. And that's because there are specifiable causes that we can see that result in events. And for any event, you can specify the causes. If you think about it long enough and study it closely enough, any event in the natural universe, we can specify the causes that led to that event. But if that's true, why should human beings be any different? And if I can specify all of the causes that lead to any of your particular actions, then it looks like you don't have free will at all, right? Because I can just say, no, it's this cause and this cause and this cause. It has nothing to do with your freedom. You were always – maybe you thought you were going to take the yogurt over the bacon, but you were always going to take the bacon. Because of we can specify all the causes that led to you taking the bacon. So it's as simple as that. And this is the problem that drove Calvin crazy, of course, and why he thought, you know, if there was a God, since God knows everything that's going to happen, what's going to happen is already going to happen. It's the exact same puzzle.
Right.
That makes the phenomenon of promises really interesting. Nietzsche, in a famous passage, says, imagine how many thousands of years of evolution of human consciousness must have had to take place in order for us merely to have the right to make promises. In other words, for us to evolve to a state where we would be able to look at the future, contemplate our actions in the future, and say, I will do this in the future, even though, you know, how much control of myself at the end of the day do I have? And it could be that control I think I have of myself is merely an illusion. That's what a lot of philosophers think is they describe freedom as what's called an epiphenomenon. That is, it's just part of your consciousness that thinks that you have freedom, but it doesn't really control it.
So if your point is valid, that we don't have as much free will as we think, in a way, that sort of takes you off the hook for inabilities to keep New Year's resolutions, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Hume talks about this. Two quick things. One nice little pithy quote on this is from Spinoza. And Spinoza says
– Old Spinoza, yeah.
Spinoza says, when a rock rolls, if a rock had consciousness, it would think, I caused that rolling. When a rock rolls, if a rock had consciousness, it would think, I caused that rolling. That's supposed to illustrate what epiphenomenalism is in a human being. You know, it's just our feeling that we caused it, when in fact we're a natural thing just like a rock. But what the Scottish philosopher David Hume said in the 18th century was that we have an awful lot of control over sort of little individual events, and many promises are just kind of little individual events, but over like kind of the grand scope of our character and our habits and our sort of ways of being in the world, mm-hmm. we have actually relatively little control, and we're pretty predictable. So there, what that means is just that there are probably certain promises that you shouldn't make. Because if you have an awareness of your own character, because you're just incapable of keeping those promises.
Well, Wayne, you sort of wonder how much awareness of your own character can any one person have? I mean, that's really a tall order in a sense that we think what you're saying is we think we know ourselves pretty well, but oftentimes we sure don't.
I think most of the times we probably don't really understand ourselves very well. And, you know, the unexamined life is the life not worth living. And basically, if you're going to really understand yourself, it requires a whole lot of work. It requires a lot of reading. It requires a lot of interacting with others. It requires an awful lot of self-reflection. And I think a lot of people are delusioned about really perhaps who they really are and what their real commitments are. And that's what causes sort of these problems. You have on one level a cognitive sense of who I am or who I want to be, but then there's this deep-seated sense of whom you really are, the things, the drives, the internal motivations for your behavior. And one of the things that can come into play here then also around promise keeping is not so much whether one is capable of keeping promises, whether one has the free will or not to do that, but whether others are bound, morally obliged, act in a morally appropriate way when they force you to keep your promises, especially if you have changed your idea. And one of the sort of classic notions is what we call the Ulysses contract, the idea that one commits oneself to something in the future. And then when one gets to that point in the future, oneself at that time says, I really don't want to do that anymore. But you've made a promise to oneself, at least, to do that, binding one's future self. And that's really what promises are in sort of a way. If we at least accept that there's some minimal notion that we do have freedom of the will, what a promise does is constrain that freedom in a meaningful way. I'm saying that in the future, I'm not going to do X, Y, or Z. I'm constraining some future action, some future self.
Well, the two of you are laying out some pretty good reasons for not making New Year's resolutions. I mean, it sounds like we're taking on more than we can chew, Clancy.
Yeah, well, I think that might be right, that the reason they call it, of course, a Ulysses contract is because of the famous story of Ulysses sailing a ship past the sirens, and he had all of his sailors stuff their ears with wax because anyone who heard the sirens singing would immediately leap into the sea and to their death. But Ulysses wanted to hear the song, so he had his sailors tie him to the mast with a rope. And this is exactly what Wayne is talking about like binding one's future self. And he was, you know, he was yelling at his sailors, release
me, go,
release
let
me, let me go, let me go. But he'd made a promise to his future self, and even though he'd changed his mind, and it's exactly what Wayne is talking about. And I think that that's right. And I also, in my own personal experience of, you know, it's a common maxim, right? It's under promise and over deliver, right?
Good way to go.
Yeah. it might be.
I prefer the opposite, but
well,
under promise and over deliver.
That's what I said. Under promise and over deliver. Promise and over deliver. Yeah, I thought you were suggesting over promise and under deliver. I was going to say that's why you made me chair of the philosophy department.
But here we go. Yeah,
but no
internal UMKZ politics.
Sorry about that. But no, I think that that's right. That what might be the best thing is to recognize that one has a kind of duty to oneself to recognize one's limitations, and then at the very least to make kind of promises to oneself or New Year's resolutions, you know, modest, achievable, realistic. Otherwise, they do just become sort of a joke. And
Well, now that we've torn down any reason, any motivation for anyone ever to make a New Year's resolution, let me get our listeners involved here. Do you keep New Year's resolutions? How seriously do you regard them? Is it the right thing to do based on what Clancy and Wayne have just laid out here? Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, there's something else that strikes me as awkward about these things, which is, you know, I guess, you know, the attempt to make a resolution has some positive force attached to it. You're trying to make a positive step mm-hmm. forward or improve yourself. And yet, it seems to me most resolutions are designed to ultimately counteract, you know, a perceived shortcoming, like being overweight or not reading enough books. So it strikes me that there's a yin and a yang to all of this. Is there a consequence to this sort of making resolutions to correct a perceived shortcoming so often, Wayne?
I think that's often why we do those types of – engage in those types of behaviors. And I think there's something good to that, right? I mean, why do we make the resolutions? Well, it's a new year. It's a new opportunity. We're starting off fresh. Mm-hmm. We recognize that we all have our limitation shortcomings, things that we would like to improve about ourselves or the world around us. And so making resolutions are an attempt to try to say, look, I want to have some positive impact on the world this year. I want – whatever it might be that you're going to do.
You mean well.
And I think that you mean well and you make a promise, and it's a reflection of what I think is one of the most fundamental components of sort of the fabric of human social interaction are promises. I mean, societies could not function without promises.
And trust,
And trust about those promises. And so this is just so you think about these on a spectrum. I think probably the most comprehensive type of promise that's documented, maybe a mortgage or something, somewhere where you sign a promissory note, right? You're going to, and it's all documented, it's all clear, we've agreed on what the terms are on one level, and then you have New Year's resolutions kind of at the other end of the spectrum. And so this is a type of behavior that can be garnered or reevaluated across a spectrum of obligations across the spectrum of behaviors. And so, yeah, breaking the New Year's resolution isn't so bad in and of itself, I don't think. But if the purpose of it is to try to say, okay, look, I'm going to take a time to self-reflect. I'm using this as an opportunity to think, where do I need to improve my life? This, I think, is something we should, in fact, all do. And then you make a commitment to, well, I'm really going to try to do X this year to improve myself or my society or my family or my job. Then I think that it's a good thing to do, mm-hmm. and I think it's something that should be encouraged. If it's just sort of, you know, the trivial sort of thing, then it really is kind of not rising, I think, to much of a level of moral consideration at all.
One other quick thing, Steve, that just kind of counterbalancing what Wayne said. This is an existentialist thought generally, and I always teach this to my students in my class on existentialism. There's this – we have a habit of thinking that, like, tomorrow I'll be happy, right? Tomorrow I'll be the person I'm supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I get this, this, and this, then I'll be happy and I'll be who I am. And I always tell my students, you know, this is a simple thing, but, you know, that day is never going to come, right? You mm-hmm. you either have to try and be the person you are today, or you're always going to be chasing after that tomorrow, that, you know, when I get this, when I get right. that, when the other happens, when I have the other accomplishment. And Nietzsche had this wonderful phrase, the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, I mentioned earlier, that he said as an epigraph to his last book, which was called Ecce Homo, Behold the Man, you know, the famous phrase that when Pontius Pilate brings out Christ. And the epigraph reads, become who you are. And it's like a funny kind of paradox, because you can't become who you are, right? Because that would be changing. Mm-hmm. But what he means by that is that we have all this, like, we have all these ideas that we should be someone else other than who we are. And it sounds a little bit like New Agey pop psychology, but maybe the idea is to let go of all of that stuff, right? That I'm supposed to be somebody other than who I am, and just kind of let myself be who I am.
816-235-2888. We're talking about the yin and yang of New Year's resolutions. Our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org. Sharon from Leawood, you're on with the ethics professors. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I've always, ever since I can remember, made New Year's resolutions, and I've kept them year after year. And amazingly, most of my resolutions are the same as they were the year before. And one would think I would be discouraged, but I've always had a sense of how to become a better me and have always believed that even a slight improvement on that continuum would advance me. And so that's why I keep doing it. And, in fact, I have gotten better as the years have gone on. And I'm curious to know what you all think of that concept.
Well, you know, I was going to say that we opened by saying that maybe people don't take them so seriously. And I was going to say at that time, my father took New Year's resolutions very, very seriously.
Some did.
And we sat down and made lists with my dad, and this was like a very earnest thing. And, I mean, it must be good for us to have goals that are achievable goals and set out and achieve those and that align us with the kinds of people that we want to be. I mean, I know I wouldn't get my writing done without resolution and a deadline, which is a kind of a promise. And I don't always keep the deadline, but I eventually keep the promise most of the time.
Yeah.
So, no, that seems to me that no one could claim that that was anything other than praiseworthy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, and all the best to both of you.
Thank you, Sharon.
All three of you.
Good phone call. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Deborah writes us this: at the end of every year, usually on New Year's Eve, I sit down with paper and pencil and make a list of things I like about myself and things I want to change about myself. This has worked very well for me, she writes, versus making resolutions. It has helped me quit smoking, be a better person, be a better employee, even to get a college degree. Pretty good.
I think I think it sort of reflects what Clancy was talking about, that there's to use it as an opportunity to think about what's good about oneself, to be happy with oneself, sort of as an existentialist point. I think that's exactly right, is that if you're constantly chasing it, things will be better if only, then things are probably never going to be better.
Well, speaking of promises, you know, political candidates these days, particularly those for president, are making all kinds of promises that may or may not ever, of course, come to pass. Here's one from Republican Rick Santorum. He says this: first, I will cut spending by $5 trillion over 5 years, repeal Obamacare and other onerous regulations, and cut non-defense spending back to 2008 levels. Very specific set of here's what I'm going to do. And President Obama, of course, very famously promised to shut down Guantanamo, the prison down there, and obviously that hasn't happened yet. So what do the two of you make of this whole idea of campaign promises? Because as most of us know, presidents can do very little unilaterally when it comes to implementing the promises they want to make here. They can't do it by themselves, Wayne.
No, they can't. And often they're what I think that campaign promises are at best are general appeals to things that I would like to do, things I might try to accomplish. And once one gets into the fray of it and figures out the complications of it, both political and otherwise, sometimes those promises ultimately can't be kept. There might be compromises that one's having to make with the people that are one's working with. And I think that that's one of the things that's really dangerous in these campaigns, is because you are basically overstating the fact.
Because you can't deliver by yourself. You can't deliver anything.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I would hope that Obama, I would hope that all of them would, in good conscience, think that, okay, these are some of the priorities. These are the things that I would want to do once I'm in office. And at least to the degree that someone is earnestly saying this, I mean, you get two levels, I guess, of campaign promises. One is the promise that someone might be making that they really don't believe has a very good chance of happening. But I'm going to promise this is something that I will seek to have happen. And then once they get into office, they seek to blame people. Well, I couldn't do it for this or this other reason. And I think one of the issues there becomes, well, how much of that did they know ahead of time? How much of the political nuances could have been easily recognized recognize that, well, this really isn't going to be something that's easy to do, or I really don't understand the issues deeply enough yet to make those decisions. And to make those types of promises, I think, is careless at best.
You know, it just seems to me, Clancy, we're getting back to this idea we started with New Year's resolutions, which is people make them with all these great intentions, but then they don't they break them as easily as campaign promises get broken. This notion of promise in our culture really sort of has a hollowed out feeling, it seems
yeah,
to me.
No, I mean, I think that's exactly right. And that's what I was going to say. And some of these campaign promises, like I would put closing Guantanamo Bay into that camp, are a little bit like, you know, my New Year's resolution to run 2 miles a day. I mean, I bet that President Obama was really sincere that he was going to close Guantanamo Bay, and mm-hmm. then he got into the political realities and the various dangers that are involved, and
right.
the fact that there's nowhere to – no state will take these people. And he's frustrated that he wasn't able to keep that promise, but he's – you know, but he fully intended to, just with me and my running 2 miles a day. But then there are other promises which are straightforwardly empty promises.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes back to Wayne's point about the difference between promises we make to others and promises we make to ourselves.
Yes.
And
yes.
Aristotle talked about this, because he wanted to distinguish between lies, and including lies one tells oneself, which was where he would put that kind of a promise where you just, in a way, you haven't thought it through enough, and President Obama hadn't thought that through enough, or I hadn't thought through my 2 mile runs enough.
Yes.
Versus what Aristotle thought of as he said, this is not these kinds of promises are not they're not we shouldn't discuss them as lies. We should discuss them as the question of justice and the breaking of contracts. And once you start thinking about it in that way, you realize mm-hmm. that in any promise, there are two parties in the contract. And so it's not sufficient to say, well, Rick Santorum is a goon for promising to cut $5 trillion from the debt. I mean, obviously, that's a completely empty promise that simply could not be accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And if it were accomplished, it would be disastrous for the country. But the other party of that contract is the voter. And before you sign a contract, you ought to think good and hard about the person on the other end of the contract and whether you want to sign off on this contract.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So we can't put all of it on the candidates.
Right. And part of it is, when is it appropriate to break a promise? You know, if I promised to come on the show today and we were driving over here and someone was laying in the street dying and we stopped.
Nope.
We help that
nope.
person.
Not going to fly with
okay,
me.
That's,
not going to fly.
Okay, well, that's not a good example.
Choose a different show.
But let's suppose that we're going
to
class.
Here, Wayne?
And,
yeah.
Walk into class and there's a kid. It's a sort of a classic example. Someone's drowning in a pond and I can stop and help that person, but it makes me late to an appointment or something. And so I break a promise to be there. I think almost all of us would say, well, here's a prime example
right.
of a situation where you've broken a promise to someone else, but it's because you had other obligations that overrode
yeah.
those. And I would think that the Guantanamo Bay could be argued like that. I made this promise, but once I got in and viewed all of the facts of the case, I had other obligations that outweighed that type of promise.
Tonia from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Well, thanks.
That's good. I was just calling to say I really like that lady who called in and said that she makes a New Year's resolution every year.
I did too.
I think it's really sweet because it's like it's kind of a lost value, I guess, being like earnest and having emotional integrity. Like I try to make New Year's resolutions and I find that I, you know, make the same one every year and I just kind of try to work at it. And sometimes I get like closer to it or I get further away, but I still, you know, try to work at it. And yeah, it's very interesting. I love that. Yeah, that's what I'd say.
Thank you for the phone call, Tania. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. And let's take a break. When we come back, we'll wrestle with the iPhone. Is it ethical to buy products made by practices we wouldn't allow in our own country? And I'm referring to iPhones being built in part by 13-year-olds in China. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Thank you. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation yesterday about dysfunction at the Kansas City Chiefs front office or our conversation about the Missouri legislature, you'll find all of that on our website, kcur.org. This hour, we're visiting with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin, both from UMKC, both philosophy wizards. We're going to turn now to a conversation that will touch a lot of people right in their cell phones. This whole notion that we're learning more and more about how iPhones are being constructed in part through the labor of 13-year-olds in China. I guess, Clancy, this all raises a question about how ethical is it to buy products made by practices, you know, we wouldn't allow in our own country?
Yeah, it's a question I work on in business ethics. One time I was in Hong Kong at the Hong Kong jewelry trade show, and we were buying pearls. And this fellow we were buying pearls from, he had fantastic prices, really nice looking stuff. And he wanted to take us to his factory, which was in mainland China. So we went to his factory, and it was this huge like series of airplane hangars, effectively, only much, much larger than an airplane hangar, and with thousands of people working in there. And he was explaining to me the benefits to us. He was saying, like, the wonderful thing is we have a medical care facility here, we have a child care facility here, we have our own little school here, and there are lots of, you know, school-age children working in the factory. So these people never have to leave. They sleep here. they never have to go outside if they
Life
don't want
good.
To. And he said, and then they get 2 weeks holiday every year, and they can go back to their home villages if they want to, and then they come back, and the rest of the 50 weeks of the year they can spend right here.
It's
and never
Nirvana,
leave.
Right?
And never leave the factory. Mm-hmm. And he was beaming at us with excitement about this. He was really proud of himself. And of course, my brother and I are looking at each other and thinking, okay, we don't care how good this guy's prices are.
Yeah.
We cannot buy these
Something's
pearls.
Not right. So,
yeah.
So your point is, could you use an iPhone given what you know about it?
I mean, it's an old problem, you know, Nike shoes in Indonesia.
Is.
And it seems to me that there's sort of a non-controversial no, that really in good conscience we can't. You know, we should not consume products that we know are being built under circumstances, social circumstances, which we would not tolerate in our own population. I mean, it's just uncontroversially wrong to do that. Now the problem is...
There's a problem here.
Yeah, the problem is we all continue to do it, and it does look as though... you know, people are going to make arguments about, well, what about lifting the circumstances of the people over there if people want the jobs? You can't really apply that argument to something like a 13-year-old. You know, mm-hmm. that might work for paying people lower wages in a different population. But when you're talking about, you know, putting people to work who we really sincerely believe should not yet be working, that argument's not going to stand up very well. And you might make some kind of argument about... sort of relative values and say, well, the Chinese have their values. Maybe our age of 16 for a child going to work is arbitrary, and
right.
and the 13-year-old is okay. Yeah, if there were a popular movement in our country to lower the age of the working minimum working age to 13, then I could kind of see that point. But otherwise, it seems to me that the answer is just no, and we are, in this instance, we are preferring our comfort and our price to what we consider to be right. And we do the same thing with Walmart, and we do the same thing with a whole host of products. It's just we want these things, and we are willing to pay a moral price for them.
And when we make these accommodations as Americans in any number of different ways, you know, Clancy mentions Nikes. We're mm-hmm, talking about mm-hmm. iPhones here.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a big chunk of the American population maybe having some moral questions surrounding their activities here.
I would say probably close to 100%.
Probably pretty close.
Each and every one of us has in our home something, some item of clothing, something that we've purchased, something that we've owned that has probably been made at the hands of someone in a fairly oppressive an oppressive circumstance, whether they're the sweatshops or whether they're in whatever country it might be. There are just a host of examples of that.
And there are examples in this country, too,
Absolutely. Yeah. There are people working. I mean, and it's not just food. It's not just clothing. It's food. If we think about the chicken, if you go look at poultry processing plants and ask, you know, what are the conditions in which those workers are working? Are they at a standard that's not raising risks to those individuals? You will find that what we want are cheap products. We want cheap food. We want cheap clothing. We want cheap iPhones.
Yeah.
Are we willing to pay $1,000 for the iPhone, which might be what it would cost if it were made in the United States by the average working adult population versus what we can get it paid for overseas? We are committing to a certain cost, and we're committing to a moral price to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult, though, for the consumer. You think about your daily going shopping, doing the things you're trying to do. You can't possibly pick each item of clothes. Okay, where was this made? I don't know. I can't track it back. But we could certainly impose regulations. We could have a situation set up such that the United States is such a huge importer of goods, and the marketplace is so strong that we could take a moral stand and say, we're not going to take items coming into this country that don't meet certain standards. That's going to raise the price of those items. That's going to cause a certain level of outrage by the consumer who wants the low prices, but I think it would be the right thing to do.
Let me just throw the gauntlet down to our listeners if anyone wants to call in and sort of try to justify why they own an iPhone given all this. I'm asking a whole lot here, I know. 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org. Well, why hasn't there been more moral sort of outrage about all of this? I mean, we sort of make, you know, big stinks about, you know, buying local when it comes to food. Sometimes that garners up a whole lot of attention. But something as ubiquitous as an iPhone, we sort of look the other way, Clancy.
Well, you know, it is a matter of seizing public attention and holding it, I suppose. I mean, when, you know, when Theodore Dreiser wrote his novels about working conditions in America, that did galvanize people, and all of a sudden we had, you know, it really helped the unions. And I think it's the job of the media to galvanize the public imagination about these kinds of things. I myself didn't know until it was called to me by your attention before coming on the show that iPhones were made by 13-year-olds. I was completely oblivious to the fact.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not the sort of thing that Apple's going to publicize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So I think it's just and also we can get a little bit – it's not just that we're moral hypocrites. It's that sometimes we can get a little bit overloaded by the kinds of moral demands that are placed upon us of just sort of living an ordinary life, and you kind of have to prioritize. And,
yes.
And at some level, it is the case, whether for better or worse, that kind of morality begins at home, and you have enough challenges just raising your family.
We have some brave callers here who want to take the challenge of talking about iPhones being built overseas, maybe with young folks doing lots of the labor. Daryl from Kansas City, Missouri, welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment as much as a question.
Yes, sir.
And I am a brand new iPhone owner. I just got it today, just activated it no more than 50 minutes ago.
You sinner.
It's okay, Daryl.
A sea of guilt washed over me because I did see, after having ordered the phone and waiting for it to arrive, the segment on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart about Foxconn, the factory that builds these phones,
yes.
How they actually even have nets for the employees who attempt suicide jumping off the buildings because they don't get to leave. So I didn't even have the gall, the cojones, if you will, to even call from that phone. I'm calling from my Google phone at this point, but it's just really tough to cope with, really.
Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do, do you think?
Well, I paid a good penny for this phone. So
yes,
I'm gonna use it.
Yeah, I understand.
I am going to use it, but it does bring a heightened level of consciousness, and there is a degree of sort of moral hypocrisy to the whole thing. We do want to be seen. We have the latest, greatest phones, but in the back of your mind, you just really cannot escape the thought that, you know, some 13-year-old kid, instead of playing on the playground or what have you, is building these phones. 35 hours a week, a day, a work day for them in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Daryl, I sure appreciate the phone call, and good luck, okay?
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, bye-bye. Casey from Lawrence. Casey, you're on Up to Date with our ethics professors. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to make a comment. I kind of put those people that don't think about where the electronics and iPhones are coming from on the same level that people don't think about where their food is coming from and the conditions in which animals are raised for our consumption.
Right, right. The list of concerns can kind of go on and on, you're saying, Casey.
Exactly.
Yeah, good phone call. Thank you for making it.
Thanks.
Rex writes us this at UpToDate@KCUR.org. He writes, the conundrum in third world countries is that, yes, the working conditions are deplorable. They don't measure up to our environmental standards. And worse, forced child labor. On the other hand, he writes, this work may be the only thing providing any income at all. Let's go to John from Kansas City, Missouri. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having my call.
Sure.
I think a couple of things come to mind with regard to the moral conundrum we find ourselves in by buying these products and things that are made in third world countries or China. The first being that there's the idea that we, beyond individual behavior, we kind of exist in an economic system that doesn't leave us a whole lot of choice with where in regard to where we are able to have these things manufactured. If I go to a store and I attempt to buy something that's made in a country where they have good labor standards and good economic standards and no child labor, I'm limited to maybe one or two things, and there are oftentimes things I don't need.
Hmm. Yeah.
And the second moral issue is there's also the implications on your morality. If you do attempt to buy things that are made in first world countries, you're going to pay more. So what's the moral hazard of what one might do to their family? And I think one of the ethics professors talked about this by spending the more money and the list of things you can buy that are made in upstanding ways is certainly not exhaustive. It goes far beyond cell phones.
Right. John, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Gentlemen, any final thoughts on the whole conundrum with the iPhone? Now that we've ruined everybody's day who owns an iPhone.
I own an iPhone. I'm sitting here with it.
What say you to end this segment?
I'm going to make a New Year's resolution to shop smartly. I mean, and I try to do that as best I can.
Yeah. Okay.
And to think about encouraging appropriate regulations that that might make us a little bit less hypocritical in our trade practices.
All right, gentlemen. Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin are our ethics professors. Wayne Vaught is interim dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Clancy Martin is chair of the Department of Philosophy. And as always, guys, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's great to be here.